Welcome to Stare Indecisis, the podcast project out of Appeal Publishing Society at the University of Victoria Faculty of Law. My name is Rachel Gardner, and I'm your host. So this episode is the final one of the season. It's our last glimpse into Volume 23 of Appeal, which was released a little bit more than a week ago. Before we begin, I'd like to thank the podcast sponsors, the University of Victoria Law Student Society, and the Continuing Legal Education Society of British Columbia. Again, without your support, this whole project would not have happened. Thank you so, so much. So due to some of our authors' professional and academic obligations, we couldn't make an episode for every paper that was published in Appeal Volume 23. But there's some good stuff in there, so if you're interested, you should check it out. I have included on the website a link to a free online version of the journal. So the papers that we didn't cover in the podcast are, first, Jessica Bond's paper on minors in the new Canadian assisted dying regime, or rather the exclusion of minors from the new Canadian assisted dying regime. Second, Sarah Chaster's take on mandatory minimum sentences. Third, a paper on preventing and controlling corruption with a focus on the Charbonneau Commission. That's also by Sarah Chaster. The appeal board picked two of her papers out of more than 80 double-blinded submissions. So well done, Sarah. And finally, Naomi Kruger's work on the problematic absence of damages in BC's Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act. But we do, fortunately, have one more episode in which we're going to showcase author Rachel Gutman. So yes, this episode will feature host Rachel G's interview with Rachel G. We open this season with Aboriginal rights, and we're closing with them as well. Rachel Gutman's paper is about the Crown's duty to consult and accommodate in the context of the Site C Dam project and its construction. I was also very lucky to catch up with our second guest, UVic Professor John Boros, who's going to help us ground Rachel Gutman's paper in some complex law, which we'll break down. So without further ado, here are our guests.
Yeah, my name is Rachel Gutman. I'm a recent graduate of the University of Victoria Faculty of Law. I graduated in the fall of 2017. I wrote this paper, The Stories We Tell, Site C, Treaty, and the Duty to Consult and Accommodate, in my second year, in a directed studies that I did with Professor Burroughs. And I just want to acknowledge, I guess, from the beginning that I'm a settler of Eastern European Jewish ancestry.
Sure. So I'm John Boros, the Canada Research Chair in Indigenous Law at the University of Victoria, and I've been teaching for about 25 years now.
At the University of Victoria, whole time?
No, so I started out at the University of British Columbia, and then I went to Osgoode Hall, then back to UBC, then U of T, and then I came to UVic in 2001, and then I went to the University of Minnesota for 5 years, 2008 to 14, and came back in 2014 again.
Okay, so you've actually been all around.
All over the place.
Before we dive into some of the substantive topics I want to talk to you about, I thought we should touch on something extremely exciting that's happening at UVic. So in the last couple of weeks, the Faculty of Law received final funding and approval of the JID program, and that's a completely unique program that will offer a joint degree in Canadian common law and Indigenous legal orders. And I know that you worked quite tirelessly alongside some colleagues at UVic, and I'm just wondering if you'd like to introduce the program and share your reaction.
Sure. So it's thrilling that we're going to be able to, for the first time in the world, teach Indigenous law formally in a law school that will lead to a degree. And we're going to do that what they call transsystemically, so learning both the common law and Indigenous law at the same time throughout the 4 years of the curriculum. And part of our inspiration comes from McGill University, where I'm on sabbatical this year, because they teach the common law and the civil law together. So basically you introduce a problem or a set of issues, and then you look at that issue from the different legal perspectives. So we're thrilled because it means that Indigenous law becomes something that is capable of studying, interrogating, applying, and the students will get an opportunity both in the classroom, and then there's two field courses which will take them into communities for 8 months of their kind of 4 years of the law degree. So that's just a dream come true. Started working on that in 1995.
Yeah. So there will be students who were born.
Yes, that's right, exactly.
Congratulations, and thanks for all your work.
Now that we've met our guests, let's hear a little bit more about Rachel Gutman's paper.
So your paper is titled The Stories We Tell, Site C, Treaty 8, and the Duty to Consult and Accommodate. Could you give us a quick overview of what the paper discusses and argues?
Yeah. So my paper discusses the 2015 Profit River decision from the D.C. Supreme Court, where Profit River First Nation and Mulberry Lake First Nations, which are both Treaty 8 First Nations, challenged the Minister of Environment's issuance of an environmental certificate for the Site C Dam. The Site C Dam is a large hydroelectric project currently being constructed on the Peace River in central British Columbia. So in this case, the Crown discharged its duty to consult, which is required whenever the Crown takes up land under treaty and puts it to an incompatible use with treaty rights. So those treaty rights are defined in treaty as the rights to hunt, fish, and trap, though I argue in my paper that they're more expansive than that. So anyway, the Crown discharged its duty to consult in taking up land, but it never determined whether the project would infringe Treaty 8 prior to issuing the certificate. So my paper argues that when taking up land under Treaty 8, the Crown ought to be required to obtain the consent and impact of First Nations when the taking has the potential to infringe Treaty 8 promises, which it would in the case, for example, the Aboriginal title. So in when there's Aboriginal title has been declared, the Crown has the requirement to obtain consent. So I'm saying that the situation or the rights enshrined in Treaty 8 are analogous to Aboriginal title, and therefore that right to consent should also exist.
Thanks. We're going to walk through that a little bit in more detail in a moment, but I want to talk about the way you open your paper. So you start by writing about the creation story of the Dene Zah. Why did you choose to start there?
Yeah. So my paper is a story about two nations who occupy the lands that make up what is now called the Peace River Valley, or the traditional territory of the Dene Zah. So the creation story of the Dene Zah is where that story begins. And I don't think you can understand the relationship between the two nations, those nations being the Dene Zah and the Crown Right of Canada, without appreciating the legal connection between the Dene Zah and their territory. The creation story is not mine to tell, so I won't repeat it, but it describes a time when water covered the world, which is interesting because archaeologists and geologists place the Dene Zah on their territory at a time when ice sheets began to melt into giant lakes and rivers, which was about 10,000 years ago. And so the creation story of the Dene Zah and other stories that are passed down over history represent legal orders. And these legal orders govern the relationship between the Dene Zah, other beings, and their land. And in Treaty 8, entering Treaty 8, Canada was able to obtain certain rights in the traditional territory of the Dene Zah. And so in order to understand these rights, you need to understand the laws of the Dene Zah and their legal relationship to the land, which is why I start off by discussing that creation story.
The Profit River decision and Rachel's critique of it have a lot of complex law underpinning them. So we're going to anchor this episode with a tour of Section 35, the duty to consult, and the numbered treaties in Canada. And I can imagine really no better tour guide than Professor John Burroughs.
So in 1982, our Constitution was patriated, meaning that the amending formula is now in Canada. We don't have to go to Great Britain to get our Constitution amended. And as a part of that patriation in 1982, Aboriginal and treaty rights were recognized and affirmed. So Section 35.1 wording is the existing Aboriginal and treaty rights of the Aboriginal peoples of Canada are hereby recognized and affirmed. And after that clause was put in, there was also Section 37 that called for first ministers' conferences to be able to negotiate the meaning of recognized and affirmed Aboriginal and treaty rights. There was a little bit of success. There was a couple of amendments to Section 35 guaranteeing Aboriginal and treaty rights equally to male and female persons, and also saying that land claims agreements were treaties for the purposes of Section 35(1). But otherwise they failed, and that failure meant that it was left up to the courts to define Aboriginal rights. So since the Sparrow case in 1990, the meaning of those words has fallen to a case-by-case determination.
So as we stand now, what does Section 35 do?
Yeah, so Section 35, by and large, says that the Crown's sovereignty is constrained whenever an Aboriginal or treaty right might be affected. So the Crown can no longer just do what it wants, because Aboriginal rights, treaty rights, are now part of the highest law of the land. Just like the Crown couldn't infringe our rights to freedom of religion or association or equality without justifying that, so it is with Aboriginal rights. So Section 35(1) constrains the sovereignty of the Crown, which says that if the rights of Aboriginal peoples are going to be affected, they have to justify that intervention. And then there's a whole lot of principles that the court has identified that the Crown would have to consider in order to have that infringement of Aboriginal rights be upheld.
Now, I want to move to the duty to consult. So the Crown bears a duty to consult when it makes decisions that adversely affect Indigenous groups, and that springs out of Section 35. So could you introduce the duty to consult and its relation to Section 35?
Sure. So the duty to consult is part of the justification process that the Crown bears in infringing Aboriginal rights. So what that means is that because the right is, again, the highest kind of law in the land, the Crown can't just do what it wants, and so it has to, through this duty to consult, engage Aboriginal peoples to figure out what are the ways that would be minimally impairing that right, allowing the right to exist as strong as it possibly can. At the same time, the Crown takes a piece of it or diminishes it somehow through its activities. So the duty to consult in the Haida case, which was the case that really promulgated the framework in 2004, said that the Crown has to make an assessment of the strength of the Aboriginal claim and the impact of its activity on the Aboriginal claim. And so if there's a strong Aboriginal claim and the impact is very high on that claim, the court says that the degree of consultation is very, very high. Maybe even consent would be necessary in some circumstances. On the other hand, if the claim was weak and the impact of the Crown activity on the claim was also very weak, it may be that all is required is just notice to the Aboriginal community as to what the Crown is going to do. It does say in the judgment that in all cases the Crown has to substantially address the concerns of Aboriginal peoples. But the point I'm making here is that the duty to consult Aboriginal peoples and then accommodate their interests falls along a spectrum. That spectrum of strong claim, high impact on the one end, and then low impact and weak claim on the other end of the spectrum. And then there's all sorts of things along the line that can, you can have a weak claim, but a strong impact on it, for instance, and that would engage the duty in another way. So it's a very contextualized doctrine.
Not a riser.
Yeah, so in 2014, the Supreme Court of Canada recognized that the Silcotin have Aboriginal title to a portion of their traditional territory. They didn't claim all of their territory. So there are areas outside of what was recognized as Aboriginal title land that they could probably bring a similar case on and potentially win. And so in that instance, they've been successful in a portion of their territory in establishing Aboriginal title. It's likely that in another part of their territory, they could also establish Aboriginal title. So that's you know, high likelihood that they have a claim that would be successful there. If part of that territory that, so say the government wants to mine that territory, and our proponent does, and the government has the approvals authority for the mining, that mining could affect their title. So that would be a very high impact activity on a very high claim instance. Potentially low impact scenarios with a low claim, let's say a group has already entered into a treaty relationship with the Crown, and the treaty says that you know, their rights are modified or extinguished, but nevertheless the Aboriginal group says, well, when we signed our treaty, you didn't recognize say intellectual property rights or something. Court would say, well, that's probably a low impact because you've already given up your rights to Aboriginal or treaty rights, Aboriginal or resource rights in that instance, and therefore low likelihood of establishing a right. And say all the Crown wanted to do was maybe put a cell phone tower in a place that already had a cell phone tower. Like, there's no new impact on that territory, and so that would be at the other end of the spectrum.
For our last bit of legal background, I asked John Burrows to give us an overview of the numbered treaties in Canada.
Yeah, so there's been over 500 treaties in Canada. There were about 350 treaties before Confederation and 150 treaties after Confederation. But for the most part, those treaties are very small-scale affairs, often like, you know, acres, for instance, that might have been given to the Crown in exchange for some benefits that an Aboriginal community might receive. So treaties has long been a part of our history, but the numbered treaties took place between, I believe it's 1871 and 1920, and they're numbered 1 to 11, and they basically extend from Ontario through to British Columbia, even to the Northwest Territories. Treaty 8, which is the numbered treaty that's in British Columbia, was signed in 1899, and that treaty was basically to allow, from the Crown's perspective, access with roads and infrastructure development in the area for mining and for forestry. They didn't really think there'd be many settlers who are non-Aboriginal living in that territory. Aboriginal peoples think that Treaty 8 was an agreement to share the land to the top 6 inches of the soil when people came in to the territory who were non-Aboriginal, and basically a little bit of a different point of view. But one of the clauses in the treaty says that the Crown has the right to take up land for the purposes of timber and mining and forestry and agriculture or any other purposes that the Crown would need the land for, as long as the Aboriginal peoples could continue to hunt and fish in those territories. And so the Treaty 8 of 1899 is basically a treaty about how the both parties are going to relate to one another and the land.
So now that we have our broad legal foundation, let's hear more from Rachel Gutman about the specific context and arguments of her paper.
Your paper moves then into a discussion of a case called Profit River, which you've already introduced, and into your critique of the decision. Could you first introduce us to the parties and then give us a quick rundown of the facts?
Sure. So in 2014, the British Columbia Minister of Environment issued an environmental certificate to BC Hydro to construct the Site C project on the Peace River. And as I already mentioned, Site C is a massive hydroelectric project, and it will flood about 5,000 hectares of land in the Peace River Valley in central BC. So the area being flooded is a traditional territory of Profit River First Nation and Mulberry Lake First Nations, who again are both signatories of Treaty 8. and are the, or were the plaintiffs in the Profit River decision. So in order to take up land for purposes of Site C, the Crown, as I explained earlier, had a duty to consult with impacted First Nations, and the Crown discharged that duty during the environmental assessment process. But despite, the projected enormous impacts the project was will have on the impacted First Nations, the Crown did not at any point determine whether the taking would amount to infringement. Rather, it just assessed the impacts of the project and attempted to mitigate them. And in the context, obviously, of a giant hydroelectric dam, it's really difficult to mitigate the effects. So the issue with that is that the Crown proceeded with a project that may represent an infringement of Treaty 8, which is a violation of Section 35(1) of the Constitution. So that section protects Aboriginal and treaty rights. And in order to infringe Section 35, the Crown is required to justify its action under a two-part test that was set out in a decision by the Supreme Court called R.D. Sparrow. And so in order to infringe treaty rights, the action must be first in furtherance of a compelling objective, and then second, it must be shown that the action is in furtherance also of the Crown's fiduciary duty to Aboriginal peoples. And so because infringement was never determined, the Crown never justified its action under this two-part test. And I guess as just a point I want to make here, my paper discusses the Sparrow test a lot, so the Sparrow test being the test required in order for the Crown to infringe Aboriginal and treaty rights. But I think it's just important to acknowledge that a lot of people believe that this test rests on problematic assumptions of Crown sovereignty and the ability of the Crown to infringe these rights. So I just want to acknowledge that now.
We moved into the issues and then the findings in the Profit River case.
Yeah, so there were two main issues that the court was looking at. So Profit River First Nation and Mobile Lake First Nations argued that the Minister of the Environment had a duty to determine the question of infringement before it issued the environmental certificate. That was the first issue to be decided. And the second was that the duty to consult had not been properly discharged.
And what was the, what did the court decide?
Yeah, so on the question of the duty to determine infringement, the court found the Minister of the Environment did not have the duty to determine infringement. The court reasoned that the minister's decision was discretionary and based on policy, not rights. And the court found that the Environmental Assessment Act did not provide the minister necessary powers to make a determination of the rights of the parties. And then the court also found that the duty to consult had properly made out. So it said that the duty to consult had been discharged at the deep end of the consultation spectrum. And it didn't discuss whether or not the duty to consult should it require a determination of infringement, but by finding that the consultation duty had been made out, I believe that it implies that the duty to consult doesn't require determination of infringement. And then another point the court made was also that the appropriate location for determination infringement is in the courts in a separate action, which was also an important point that was made.
Yeah, you have some criticisms of the decision, and specifically, well, I know you have some criticisms of the call for a separate action. Could you address some of those criticisms that you cover in your paper?
Yeah. So I guess I'll discuss the issue of having a determination of infringement in the courts first. So my concern is that if the minister doesn't have to determine infringement, and the duty to consult doesn't require determination of infringement, then who on the part of government is responsible for ensuring that its actions don't infringe Section 35? So the court suggests that the burden lies with the impacted First Nations bring an action in court to uphold their rights. But I argue that's a really big burden to place on First Nation litigants. Firstly, a court has never ruled on a case where a Treaty Nation has alleged that the Crown has infringed treaty rights. And second, litigation is very expensive, and these types of claims can take years to resolve. So a project might be well underway when a declaration of infringement is made by a court. And so, you know, in fact, in this case, Site C, billions of dollars have been spent on construction, and there has never been a termination of infringement. And then the second issue I have with the decision, I guess to put simply, is that I frankly don't agree with the court's interpretation of Treaty 8, which grounds its decision. And I think it's important to acknowledge that this disagreement isn't just with the decision of Profit River, but a series of decisions from the Supreme Court of Canada discuss and interpret Treaty 8. So the Supreme Court of Canada and decisions in Nikkasu Cree and Grassy Narrows, which are important cases on the duty to consult in the context of a number treaty, assert that the written text of the treaty had the effect of surrendering Aboriginal rights and title for treaty rights. So member treaties often have a clause in them which purports that the signatory surrendered and ceded all their rights and title to the land described in the treaty document. And so my argument is that the jurisprudence in Nikkasu Cree, Grassy Narrows, and other common law decisions fail to interpret Treaty 8 with respect to the perspective of signatory nations. Yeah. And so I argue that signatory nations enter Treaty 8 in order to ensure the continuation of their way of life and culture. And they didn't view Treaty 8 as surrendering their rights and title. Rather, the agreement was entered in order to ensure the continuation of their way of life. And then I argue that treaty rights are actually proven rights, not to have the same substantive protections as proven Aboriginal rights and title. So in the 2014 Silk Road decision, the court held in the context of an Aboriginal title claim that consent is always required prior to an incursion of Aboriginal title. And where consent is absent, the Crown is required to justify its action using the two-part Sparrow decision test, which I talked about earlier. So I argue that treaty rights should be understood as proven rights, and the same duty should be applied to the treaty context. So when taking up land, the potential harm is so great that it may infringe a treaty right, the Crown ought to be required to obtain consent, and where consent is not given, justify the incursion under that two-part Sparrow test, as it would in the case of Aboriginal title.
So the Site C Dam got its origin under a Liberal government, but in December of 2017, Premier John Horgan confirmed that our current NDP government will be proceeding with the project. So I'll read you an excerpt from a press release he did. It says, "It's clear that Site C should never have been started, but to cancel it would add billions to the province's debt, putting at risk our ability to deliver housing, childcare, schools, and hospitals for families across BC. And that's a price we're not willing to pay." So what's your reaction to that statement?
Yeah, I was really frustrated when I saw that, because I think it kind of created a false dichotomy that, of affordability versus respecting treaty rights. And I don't think it's necessarily up to the province to make this decision and make that calculus that it's going to prioritize housing and childcare and affordability. Not that these things aren't something the government should prioritize, but I don't think it can do that at the expense of constitutionally protected rights. Under Section 35, in order to infringe a treaty right, the Crown has to meet a legal test. It's called the Sparrow test, and it requires the Crown to justify the incursion. And in the case of Site C, there's never been justification. So, until that's done, I don't think that it's up to the NDP to make this prioritization.
So we started this episode with the legal framework surrounding Section 35 and the duty to consult. Then we moved into Rachel's critique to the effect that the Crown should be obliged by Section 35 to determine whether taking up land for the Site C Dam will infringe Aboriginal rights. But now I want to move outward again to share our guest perspectives on this shifting and crucial area of the law. So let's start with John Boroughs.
So I want to talk a bit more broadly about Section 35 again, because that provision has seen a lot of different interpretations since its enactment in 1982, and I think there's a lot of work ahead. So I'm just wondering what you see as the biggest legal questions to be answered in the next generation or so.
Yeah. One of the things that the court has not really addressed in the treaty context is whether or not Aboriginal peoples have rights to governance in relationship to the resources and the issues that are talked about within the treaty. And there's an Aboriginal rights case, which is not a treaty case, that the court said Aboriginal peoples don't have a general right to self-governance because that wasn't integral to their distinctive culture prior to the arrival of Europeans. They might have a right to governance on an issue-by-issue claim. So far, there's been really no successful cases at the higher courts establishing that Aboriginal peoples have an Aboriginal right to governance on a case-by-case basis. But in the treaty context, it's possible to argue that when Indigenous people sat down with the Crown, either there was an understanding that they would continue to govern the resources that was recognized that they could continue to use that are part of the treaties, and so governance might be a treaty right in that regard. Or another alternative interpretation is that the parties really didn't think about governance at the time treaties were being negotiated, particularly Indigenous governance. And the theory in that instance would be if the parties didn't talk about it, then those rights are reserved to the Aboriginal peoples themselves. That is, if the Aboriginal peoples didn't give away the right to governance to the Crown, then Aboriginal peoples, Indigenous peoples, can still exercise those rights to governance today. You know, whatever is not surrendered remains with the group. And so either of those two theories, I think, will be part of the future debates around treaties. And then the question becomes, do Indigenous peoples have the right to prevent the Crown or stop the Crown or transform what the Crown is doing on a governance footing, not just a consultation or accommodation footing, but in fact they either have the right to govern those resources or there's some kind of co-governance regime that's been set up by the treaties that allows for their decision-making and dispute resolution power in relationship to the activities that are happening on the territory.
And how would you like to see the law go?
I would like to see it go in that second direction, actually, which is generally the treaties don't talk about Indigenous governance, and so that would be the case that Indigenous governance is reserved to the groups. It's not surrendered, it's not given up, therefore it remains with them. And then if Indigenous peoples have sovereignty, as well as the Crown having sovereignty, then what you need to do is either negotiate a new relationship or create a set of doctrines that would allow for some kind of exclusive exercise of sovereignty in certain instances, that can be complicated, but nevertheless you could have exclusive Crown sovereignty in some areas, exclusive Indigenous sovereignty in other areas, and then there would be those areas where the sovereignties would overlap. So just like in federalism, where provincial government and federal government might be in the field, there's all sorts of doctrines that deal with those overlapping powers, and I think we could bring some of that by way of analogy to the Indigenous context. Sometimes people talk about treaty federalism.
I asked Rachel what she found exciting about Aboriginal law.
Yeah, I guess what I find exciting about the theory of the law isn't so much the common law jurisprudence right now, but I think the opportunity to weave Indigenous laws, into Canadian law. I think there's a lot of exciting things happening right now with, different Indigenous nations, applying and using their laws in really interesting ways. So I think that's very exciting.
So before wrapping up, I want to turn again to creation stories, which is the way you opened and closed your paper. What are the two creation stories you see at play, and why are they important?
Creation stories, you know, they establish the origins of people in the places in which they live, and they also set out rules and laws governing the way in which people live, you know, in the areas that they describe. And so I started my paper with the Dinezak creation story. But Treaty 8 can also be thought of as a creation story. It sets out how people came to live in the land it describes. So, you know, if we understand, we can understand Treaty 8 as you know, First Nation signatories giving the Crown Right of Canada the right to uses of those lands. And Treaty 8 also sets out laws governing how people live on those lands and the relationship between settlers and First Nations. And I guess I argue that the interpretation of the creation story of Treaty 8 by the courts ignores the creation story of the Dene'eza and the, you know, the relationship that the Dene'eza have with you know, their lands, and you know, treats these two stories as being mutually exclusive. You know, interpreting Treaty 8 as having extinguished you know, the laws and rights the Dene'eza have on their lands.
We're going to close with John Boroughs.
So Rachel Gutman's paper opens and closes by talking about the creation story of the Dene'eza, and I think it's quite topical because you've just come from a conference on spirituality and reconciliation, and I'm wondering if you'd like to share your thoughts on the role of origin stories in reconciling legal orders.
Yeah, so we have an origin story in Canada that's a part of our constitution that we look to all the time in making decisions. The court has said that our Constitution in the British North Air America Act, or the Constitution Act 1867, says that Canada's Constitution is similar in principle to that of Great Britain. So part of our origin story as Canadian constitutional lawyers is to see that we have this long oral tradition that stretches back through the ages that protects our ability to be able to participate with one another through a parliamentary process. And then we've since added individual rights protection onto that through 1982's Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So we have an origin story in Canada that's an oral tradition that is about democracy and acting through collective will. Indigenous peoples also have origin stories, and they're also based on oral traditions, and they're often also about protecting the collective will of the community. And so many of the origin stories are creation stories about how the people came to be in a territory and what their responsibilities are to one another as a result of the principles and the processes that are described in the creation stories, you know, constitutive parts. So often, like with the Dene'eza, the Dene creation story, there will be animals that will talk with humans or have some kind of agency. And it indicates that a part of Indigenous law's origin stories are that the world is alive, that animals have this place where they can be accounted for and accommodated and talked to in thinking about what our obligations are, not just to one another as humans, but to the water, to the air, to the fire, to the insects, the plants, the animals, the fish, the birds, etc. So in other words, our origin stories as Indigenous peoples, when we talk about what our obligations are to the collective, part of the collective is actually the natural world around us. And, you know, that's obviously in contrast to the Canadian general origin story. But there's also comparative elements, right? They're both origin stories. They're both about protecting a community. They both have kind of oral traditions about what is necessary to help in the protection of that community. And so one of the things I'd like to see in the future is these origin stories interact more fully so that we can obviously take the best elements of British constitutionalism, which I'm very much in favor of, I think there's a lot of wisdom in that tradition, even though it's got a colonial element that's horrific. In other instances, it really does a lot to protect people's ways of life in multitudes of ways. And of course, I'm very high and very favorably about Indigenous peoples' origin stories and constitutions as well. And I think if we put them in conversations with one another, comparing and contrasting, we can take the best of both systems and obviously continue to work through Parliament to try to advance our sense of what's best for one another, but also add to that kind of Parliament of the Earth, where we would think about what do the beavers or the winds or the insects say, or what would we do to take account of their role as agents, active participants in the existence of life on the Earth. And so I think that's a part of why Rachel told that story, is to show that there are standards for judgment in Indigenous constitutional stories that can act as authority, as precedent. They can guide our decision making. They can be reasons for decision or resources for reasoning.
Thanks to our guests, Rachel Gutman and Professor John Boros. Thanks to Erin Fletcher from the Appeal Submissions team for her help with this episode. Thanks to CFUV Radio for their equipment and expertise. And thanks to you, our listeners, for taking part in Appeal's first foray into the audio world. It's been such a privilege to put this project together. I'll see you around.